Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Jonas Olsen. He's professor of practical philosophy at Stockholm University in Sweden. His research areas include metaethics and related subjects. So, Dr. Olsen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much, Ricardo. Pleasure to be here.
So, I mean, it's interesting because I've already talked with several ethicists and moral philosophers on the show, but today I would like to go a little bit back to the basics because I'm not sure I ever asked this question on the show, just for people to get a little more familiarized with what you do in ethics. So could you tell us about the difference between metaethics, normative ethics, and applied ethics?
So you mentioned three sub-disciplines of moral philosophy. There's applied ethics, there's normative ethics, and there's meta-ethics. And perhaps it's best to start with applied ethics. And to give you an idea about what we're interested in applied ethics, let me give you some examples. So typical questions in applied ethics are, is it morally permissible to eat factory-farmed meat? Is euthanasia permissible? Is abortion morally permissible? These are specific issues about specific action types, whether they are morally right or morally wrong. That's the aim in applied ethics is to try to answer these questions. And in normative ethics, the aim is to find more, so to speak, systematic answers to moral questions. So we try to formulate theories that will enable us to answer questions in applied ethics. Mm-hmm. So, for example, what is it that, so a typical question in normative ethics will be, what is it that makes an action right or wrong? Can we give some sort of unified or systematic answer to that question? And the big well-known theorists in this area are, of course, utilitarianism, Kantianism, virtue ethics, there is theories of rights, and so on. And they all give competing answers to this question, what it is that makes an action morally right or morally wrong. And of course, the borders between the border between applied ethics and normative ethics is not clear cut, as you can see, because one will often when one tries to answer questions in applied ethics, one will often appeal to theories that we formulate in the discipline of normative ethics. Now, both applied ethics and normative ethics are so to speak normative disciplines. They try to answer questions about what's right and wrong, mm-hmm. what's good and bad, what's virtuous and vicious, and so on, what's fair and what's unfair. But then there is also normative ethics. There is also meta-ethics. That's a more abstract discipline. In meta-ethics, we do not ask questions about what is right and wrong, and good or bad, fair and unfair, virtuous and vicious, and so on. But we ask rather, what is it for an action, for example, to be morally right or to be morally wrong? Mm-hmm. What is it? Does an action that is wrong have the property of being moral wrong? Are there moral properties of rightness and wrongness? So that's a metaphysical or ontological issue in metaethics. We also ask questions, what is it that we do when we utter moral sentences? When I say, for example, that euthanasia is wrong, am I making an assertion? Or am I rather issuing a prescription? Or am I expressing a desire or an emotion of something, or something of that sort? So these are semantic issues, mm-hmm. about moral statements. And there's also epistemological issues in metaethics. So can we know, for example, that euthanasia is wrong? Can we have moral knowledge? That's also not in itself a normative issue. It's not a moral issue, at least. It's a question rather about rightness and wrongness. And then there are also psychological questions about how moral judgments connect to our motivation to act and so on. And these are questions in moral psychology. And usually these issues are also categorized under the label of metaethics. Yeah, mm-hmm. So that's a rough outline of the distinctions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a good summary. So since you work primarily in metaethics, could you tell us about what are some of the most prominent approaches or theories there?
Well, I think it's helpful to organize metaethics around these questions that I mentioned. So there are the ontological issues. Are there moral facts or moral properties? If so, what's the nature of moral facts and moral properties? Here we can distinguish between those that are, realists, and the realists think that there are moral properties. The anti-realists think that there are no moral properties. And then there is a debate, of course, between realists. What's the nature of moral properties? Are they natural, naturalistic, or are they rather non-natural? Are they sort of radically different from the properties that that the natural sciences and the social sciences deal with, for example? Then we have the semantic issue that I mentioned. What is it that we do when we utter moral sentences? Are we making assertions, or are we expressing emotions or something of that sort? And here is here the big divide is between what is called often called cognitivism. That's the idea that when we utter moral sentences, we express beliefs, we make assertions. And the other side then is called non-cognitivism. That's the idea that we do not, primarily at least, express our beliefs when we make moral judgments, when we utter moral sentences. Rather, we express some sort of emotion or desire, like attitude, or maybe a prescription or something of that sort. And then there is the question about epistemology. Can we know that an action is right or wrong? For example, here the divide is between the moral skeptics and the, it's not really a, there's no real good name for the other side, but let's call them non-skeptics. The realists are normally non-skeptics, people who think that there are moral facts and moral properties. Most of them think that we can also come to know these facts, some of them at least. And then in questions about moral psychology, well, there's a cluster of issues in moral psychology, but one prominent debate in moral psychology concerns the connection between accepting a moral judgment or endorsing a moral judgment, for example, that it's wrong to eat meat, and being motivated to act in accordance with that judgment. So, for example, if I sincerely judge that eating meat is wrong, am I thereby motivated not to eat meat? People who think that there's a necessary connection, they're called moral internalists, because they think that the connection between accepting the judgment and being motivated is internal and necessary. And the opposing side is called externalism. That's the idea that there is no necessary connection between endorsing the moral judgment and being motivated to act in accordance with it. And of course, these are separate questions, but they are connected, as you can perhaps suspect already. So, as I mentioned, people who are realists, they tend also to be non-skeptics. They tend to be cognitivists, and they also, well, most of them are also externalists. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we will get into some of those specific approaches you mentioned and some of those questions. So a specific question I have for you is, so there's error theory. Could you tell us about it and how it applies to metaethics specifically?
Mm-hmm. Error theory is, it's a theory that There are other error theories in many areas of philosophy, not just in ethics, but it's perhaps most well known within ethics. Mm-hmm. To go back to the four questions that I just mentioned, it's a theory that is very similar, actually, to a typical or standard realist view. It's just that it differs on one crucial point. So error theorists typically think that when we utter moral sentences, we make assertions. Mm-hmm. We make statements that can be true or false. And in fact, they're all false, or at least untrue, according to error theory. So error theorists are cognitivists. They are skeptics because they think that no moral judgment is true. Mm-hmm. And of course, knowledge implies truth. So we cannot have moral knowledge, according to error theorists. So where error theorists differ from realism is on the crucial point about metaphysics. So error theorists think that there are no moral properties, and some of them go as far as saying that there cannot be any moral properties. Moral properties are impossible. It's useful to compare moral language as error theorists see it with, say, discourse about witches, right? So a witch is a woman with magical powers who travels on a broom to Blåkulla with her cat and so on. But of course, there are no such beings. There are no women or men, for that matter, with magical powers who travel on a broomstick to Blåkulla. So any attribution of the property of being a witch to someone is mistaken. Mm-hmm. Any sentence, any claim to the effect that someone is a witch is false, because nothing has the property of being a witch. Similarly, according to error theory, nothing has the property of being morally wrong or morally right. So all statements are either false or untrue, according to error theory. This sounds radical, of course, and perhaps crazy. Maybe it is, but the claim from the error theorist is that when we think hard about what moral properties would have to be like, what moral facts would have to be like, mm-hmm. we can come to realize that there can be no such entities. So there are no moral properties, and that's why our moral statements are uniformly false or untrue. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, before asking you more about error theory and how it applies to ethics, let me just sort of get into a follow-up question to what you said. What would it mean for there to be moral properties, or does it mean different things for people with different approaches within, let's say, moral realism?
Mm-hmm. So this is, like I said, this is a big debate within moral realism, or between moral realists. What's the nature of moral properties? And one traditional divide is between the naturalists and the non-naturalists. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm not sure that distinction is crucial, actually, because let me start from another note. What is it that error theorists find so queer or mysterious about moral facts and moral properties? Well, let's start with other kinds of normative requirements. Mm-hmm. We know what it is for there to be rules of chess, for example, rules of etiquette. Yeah. So etiquette requires various things, that you do not, what is it, that you do not eat peas with a spoon, and that you do not wear, I don't know, maybe it's etiquette, or it's whether it's etiquette or fashion that requires you not to wear pink with purple. I don't know, but there are these this set of requirements that we get from etiquette, and when we play chess, there is this set of rules that we have to comply with. Now, is it mysterious that there are such things as wrong from the point of view of etiquette, or wrong according to etiquette, and wrong according to the rules of chess? No, that's not a mystery, because these rules and requirements are conventional. They are somehow the result of agreements that we have made, and that have have evolved over the years, sometimes over many years. So these are not mysterious. But the claim from error theorists, and also a claim that many realists make, is that moral requirements are different, crucially different from conventional requirements. So moral requirements are independent of our attitudes. Moral requirements are not conventional, because if they were conventional, that would mean that if our conventions were to change, then, for example, torturing people just for fun could be, or would be, morally permissible. Mm-hmm. But the claim from many realists is that that's not right. I mean, the wrongness of torturing someone for the mere fun of it is non-conventional. It's perhaps a necessary truth, according to many moral realists. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, this means that moral norms are, in a sense, objective, in a sense that makes them different from the norms of etiquette and the norms of chess and so on. These are not objective, because they are the results of our conventions. So they are, in a crucial sense, subjective. Now, objectivity in itself is not a mystery. There are objective truths according to many error theory, according to most error theorists. But the moral norms are also prescriptive. Mm-hmm. Okay, they require certain behavior, and it's the combination of objectivity and prescriptivity that's strange or mysterious according to error theory. So prescriptivity in itself is not a mystery. The rules of chess, again, the rules of etiquette, they're prescriptive, they tell us how to act, but they're not objective. Okay. I would say logical truths and mathematical truths are plausibly viewed as objective, but I don't see them as prescriptive. So again, they're not queer because they're not objective and prescriptive. But again, the moral norms, moral facts would have to be both objective and prescriptive. And when we think hard about it, we can come to realize that there can be no such properties or facts. That's the claim from error theory.
Mm-hmm. So
let me just add and explain perhaps that the expression objective prescriptivity comes from John Mackey, who is the most well-known error theorist in ethics. He wrote a book in 1977 that became very influential. In my own work, I've used a different expression most of the time. I've used the expression irreducibly normative, mainly because that's an expression that's been used by many other contemporary philosophers in the metaethical debate, like Derek Parfit and David Enoch, for example. I would say that the idea is really the same. The phenomenon that we're trying to capture is really the same. Mackey talks about objective prescriptivity, and I and others talk about irreducible normativity. So the idea is that the normative requirements, they do not reduce to anything like conventions or desires or aims, something that is not normative or that can be explained in non-normative terms. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So would it be right to say that error theorists think that the issue here is that we have certain psychological predispositions when it comes to how we interact with other people, how we establish relationships with them, whether they come from our evolved psychology, for example. And so we would have certain innate predispositions and moral emotions that would lead us to want to act and expect from people certain specific behaviors, or they come from socialization and perhaps also game theory. I mean, how we learn to interact with other people or even culture. And I mean, and those kinds of psychological predispositions can change or could have changed if we have evolved in different conditions, or if we were exposed to different societies or different cultures, and so they do not have an objectivity to them.
That's exactly right. That's how most error theorists think about morality. So error theorists are they take a naturalistic perspective on morality. They try to explain how morality has evolved using sort of arguments from and results from evolutionary biology and cultural evolution and game theory and as you said, and they try to often try to give a story about how our moral judgments have evolved and why we talk about moral rightness and wrongness and why it's so important for us to talk about right and wrong and also to why it's important for us to believe that there are these objective prescriptive norms, whereas in fact there are no such norms. Now, error theorists don't have to take precisely that view. I mean, there are there can be, or there are error theorists that rest on different foundations. So, for example, a Marxist might say that the morality in our society is largely a product of bourgeois society and bourgeois norms and so on. And you can and there is the Nietzschean view that says that, well, this is a product of sort of the herd and the thing we call morality is actually slave morality and so on. And it's the Übermensch who are being oppressed and so on. So these are sort of well, there are different grounds on which you can build your error theory. But for sure, the most popular view in contemporary meta-ethics is that is to give this complex story about why we have moral language and moral thought that you sketched. Yes.
Is there a relationship between error theorists and moral abolitionists? And by the way, please tell us what moral abolitionists are.
Yeah, so moral abolitionism is the view. It's actually, I think it's actually fair to call it a prescriptive view. It says that we should stop using moral language. So we should stop talking about what's morally right and what's morally wrong and so on. It's fair to ask what's the status of this should, and I think that's an important question for abolitionists to address. You might think that abolitionism is the sort of natural next step if you're an error theorist, if you believe that there are no moral properties, no moral truths, no moral facts, and that your moral utterances as a consequence are uniformly false, then the sort of natural next step is to abandon moral discourse and stop talking about rightness and wrongness. But that's actually not what most error theorists recommend. There are some who do that, but it's actually not the most popular view. And it's interesting, I think, to note that those who have defended abolitionism have often done it using what seem to be sort of moral arguments. They have argued that our current moral discourse lead to, or at least promote, sort of sustained oppression and inequalities and so on, and leads to unnecessary emotions of guilt and so on. And these sound to me like sort of moral considerations, and that makes me wonder what makes me strongly suspect that there is no necessary link between error theory and moral abolitionism.
So there's also this approach that I read about in your work, negotiationism. What is it about, and what does it have to do with error theory?
Let me try and answer that question in a sort of indirect way. There is a question that's being debated in contemporary metaethics, in the part of the metaethical debate that's connected to error theory, and that is the so-called what's next question, or the what now question. And this question is the following: so suppose that you come to believe that error theory is true. What is the upshot for moral discourse and thought? What to do with moral thought and discourse if you come to believe that error theory is true? Well, like I said, at first glance, you might think that abolitionism is the right option. I mean, when we realize that that there are no witches, you might think that we stopped talking about witches. I guess we didn't, but anyway, you might think that we should stop talking about witches because there are only such beings. But like I said, abolitionism is not the most popular alternative. It's not the most popular answer to the what's now question. Another answer to the question that has been extensively debated, and that has been fairly popular in debate, is fictionalism. Fictionalism is the idea that we should, as it were, revise our moral thought and discourse so that we use moral language in a way that is similar to the way we use fictional language. So making a moral judgment, uttering a moral sentence, would be something like telling a story. Okay, and then there are different philosophical views about what it is to tell a story. What is it to say that Sherlock Holmes lived on Baker Street, or that Frodo found the ring, or whatever? What is it to make such statements? That's the fictionalist view, and the attraction of the fictionalist view is that for the sort of selling point of fictionalism is that we it allows us to use moral language, engage in moral thought in a way that doesn't commit us to falsehoods, doesn't commit us to uttering falsehoods and so on. Okay, but then there are several problems with fictionalism. I've criticized fictionalism in my own work, and I have instead proposed that one attractive alternative for an error theorist is to recommend that we go on using moral thought and discourse, even though we believe that it's false, because it's useful for various purposes to use moral language. It's useful for coordination, for trying to reach agreement. It's useful for putting pressure on others and on ourselves in various ways. And the claim is that, I mean, and this is largely an empirical speculation, the empirical claim or hope perhaps is that moral thought and discourse can preserve these functions, even though we believe that that the statements themselves are false. So that view I have called in my work conservationism, because, well, for obvious reasons, the idea is that we do not revise moral language and thought in the way that functionalism proposes. That kind of revision is unnecessary from the conservationist point of view. Okay, and now we come to negotiationism, and that's a term that was actually invented by my colleague Jan Eriksson. He and I wrote a paper together. And in that paper we discuss, okay, so conservationism, what does conservationism say? Well, it says that it's useful in various ways to preserve moral thought and discourse. And you might think, oh, okay, so that's not very illuminating. Might we be able to say more about how to use it, when to use it, and so on? And that's the kind of questions that negotiationism tries to answer. And to make a long story short, it recommends that we are sort of careful about when and where to use moral language, not to overdo it, and to view it as a kind of negotiation. We use it when it's useful in various ways. So negotiationism is really a development of conservationism, or a version of conservationism, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just before moving on to the next topic, these two different claims, I mean, coming from error theorists that say that there are no objective moral properties or objective moral facts to be found out there, and the abolitionists who say that because of that we should avoid using moral language, let's say. I mean, these are two very different claims, right? I mean, just because someone believes in the first, it doesn't imply that she should also believe in the second. I mean, because the second is also, it also seems normative in the way,
yeah,
right, that we shouldn't use moral language.
Yeah, indeed. Exactly. So I think that what, and of course that is an issue. I mean, the question about the status of the should, mm-hmm, in the response to the what now question, that's a question that every error theorist will have to answer. Even the fictionalist who thinks that we should revise our moral thought and discourse, and the conservationist who thinks that we should preserve it. And the way I think of it, and I guess the way most error theorists think of it, is that when we say what we should do, that's really a recommendation about how we can best promote satisfaction of our desires, how we can at some collective level, how we can best bring about a peaceful and orderly society. Because again, that's many error theorists see moral thought and discourse as important devices in bringing about peaceful and orderly societies, and sort of putting pressure on ourselves and others, mm-hmm, to make us agreements and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it follows more or less along the lines of some of the debates surrounding free will, where there are some people that even if they don't believe that free will really exists, they still say that we should believe in it for us to have, let's say, a more peaceful society and for a legal system to be possible.
Exactly. It's precisely the same issue. In fact, when it comes to free will, it might even be impossible to not to believe that we have free will, right? I mean, it's difficult to be an agent if you think that all of your actions are completely determined by things that are outside of your control. And maybe it's similar with morality in the larger sense. Perhaps we cannot avoid thinking in moral terms. And of course, then you might think this is something that we haven't addressed and that perhaps we should. You might wonder, well, why not say then that so realism is false or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are alternative options after all. There is non-cognitivism, for example. But then the idea is that, well, in metaethics, we are pursuing a descriptive project, right? So metaethics is not normative. We are describing our moral thought and discourse. And the claim from the error theorist is that the best descriptive account of what it is that we do when we utter moral sentences is that we make assertions. We attribute properties. So, of course, there are other theories about what we do, but these theories are descriptively inaccurate, is the claim. There are various phenomena that non-cognitivism, for example, cannot account for.
Yes, and I mean, in this case, assuming that it's not possible for people to not believe or at least behave according to the belief that there are, in fact, moral truths out there, and we behave according to that. I mean, perhaps even if we want to address some metaphysical questions, like if there's really moral truths out there or not to be discovered, I mean, perhaps we just have to accept that people operate that way, and then when it comes to more normative ethics, let's say, or applied ethics, just try to figure out what's best for people according to our psychological needs and predispositions.
I think that's largely how Mackie thought of it, roughly. I mentioned Mackie before. He wrote this famous book in 1977, and as everyone knows who have read it, the first chapter starts with a defense of moral error theory. So he argues that there are no moral truths, no moral facts, and then he goes on in the rest of the chapters, whatever it is, 10 or 11 chapters, arguing about right and wrong, arguing about normative issues, right? Trying to formulate the best normative theory. And you might wonder, well, what's this? What kind of psychological dissonance is happening here? But I think his project was to find. I mean, his starting point was that we need morality for various purposes. We need it for coordination purposes and so on. So we need to find a systematic theory. We need to find something that works, something that is acceptable. And in that project, we have to, in that endeavor of formulating such a theory, we have to appeal to our considered intuitive judgments. So we can use something like the method that Rawls uses and that he calls the method of reflective equilibrium. It's just that, well, what we end up with might be literally false, or will be literally false, right? Because there are no moral properties again. But again, we need something that works for practical purposes. So the justification for normative ethics would be pragmatic, rather than sort of truth seeking on Mackie's view.
So what is the best way of understanding moral certitude? Where does it come from?
Okay, so this is another topic that I have worked on, mostly with my colleague Christer Bykvist, who is also a professor in Stockholm, and recently also with Stina Björkholm, who's a researcher in Stockholm. So this is actually one I mentioned a moment ago that competing metaethical theories like non-cognitivism, for example, or expressivism, as it's usually called nowadays. Well, first of all, these theories have the advantage that they do not imply that our moral judgments are systematically mistaken, and that they are uniformly untrue. And I concede that that's an advantage, of course. That's an attractive feature of these theories. But I think the problems with those kind with those theories are bigger than the advantages. There are some well-known and very extensively debated problems, like the Frege-Gietsch problem, that has to do with how moral terms behave when they are embedded and so on. But there's another problem that is in a way related, but more that has to do more with the psychology of moral judgment than with the semantics of moral judgment. And that is what you refer to as moral certitude. So what's the phenomenon? Well, the starting point is that just as we can be more or less certain about empirical matters, I mean, I can be more or less certain about what's the capital of Bolivia, and I can be more or less certain that I don't know, that my car is where I put it yesterday. I can be more or less certain about that. I can also be more or less certain about moral issues, like whether abortion is wrong, whether euthanasia is wrong, whether it's permissible to eat meat, and so on. Okay, so just as our degrees of belief can vary in empirical cases, our degrees of belief can vary about moral matters as well. Okay, so that's a sort of that's a phenomenon that is, I think, undeniable, or at least very hard to deny, very difficult to deny. So you have to accommodate it, and it's no problem accommodating it for those who those theorists who maintain that moral judgments are beliefs. Okay, those theorists that claim that when you hold the opinion that euthanasia is wrong, for example, you believe something about euthanasia. You believe that it has the property that that action type has the property of being morally wrong. It's no problem there, right? Because it's the mental state in this case is belief, just like it's belief in the empirical case or the non-moral case. Okay, but now non-cognitivism, more expressivism again. Those theorists hold that when you endorse a moral view, when you hold a moral opinion, you do not primarily hold a belief. Okay, it's rather that you hold an attitude, a non-cognitive attitude of say approval or disapproval or like or dislike or desire or whatever. Okay, so to think that euthanasia is wrong according to these theorists is not to believe that euthanasia has a property of being morally wrong. It's rather to disapprove of euthanasia. Okay, so what is it then to be more or less certain about the wrongness of euthanasia? Well, here's the problem for non-cognitivism. They cannot accommodate, or they cannot account for this feature of moral judgment in the right way. They can, I mean, the natural idea is, of course, to say that, well, degrees of belief is to be understood as degrees of attitude. So to be highly certain that that euthanasia is wrong is to disapprove strongly of euthanasia. That's one natural proposal. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't work, because there is also an additional feature of moral judgments, and that has to do with, you can use different names, but let's call it importance. Okay. So how important is it? Some things are, as it were, greater wrongs than others. So murdering someone is a greater wrong than, say, punching someone in the face or something like that. Okay. There's a greater wrongness attached to murdering someone. It has greater importance than punching someone in the face. Okay, so how do you account for that? Again, a natural response from the again, it's no problem for the cognitivists, right?
Mm-hmm.
because believing that someone is more or less important is just holding your regular belief with a spec, of course. But anyway, it's not a special problem. But how do you account for the phenomenon of importance if you're a non-cognitivist? Well, again, the natural proposal is to appeal to degrees of attitude. But now you have a problem because we have tried now to accommodate certitude and importance in the same way, namely in degrees of attitude, degrees of approval or disapproval. But the problem is that these things can vary independently. So, for example, you can be highly certain that abortion is wrong, but it's not a great moral wrong. Okay. Or perhaps the other way around is more common, that you are not very certain that abortion is wrong, but if it is wrong, it's a great wrong. Okay, so that's how these two dimensions can vary independently, and the problem is for non-cognitivism to accommodate them in the right way. And we've actually so the history of this argument is that well, actually, the first person to make this argument that I know of is Lars Bergström, who is a now retired professor in Uppsala. He made the argument in a Swedish textbook, actually, in 1990. But then it became more familiar in the contemporary sort of international debate when Michael Smith published a paper in, I think it was 2002, perhaps, something like that. And then Christer and I developed the argument. And then several people have tried to respond in various ways on behalf of non-cognitivism. And I think we've written, I don't know, three or four articles criticizing these attempts. And I think that, well, it's fair to say at least that no response from the non-cognitivists have gained acceptance, surely not universal acceptance so far. So I think this is an underexplored problem for non-cognitivism that is general and very important, and I think it's equally important as the much more well-known problem called the Frege-Gitsch problem or the embedding problem. So I think it's it's from my point of view it's a stimulating problem.
Mm-hmm. So I have two more topics I want to explore today. I want to get now specifically into a position held in metaethics by some moral anti-realists. I want to ask you about moral nihilism. I mean, first of all, does it also have any relationship with abolitionism that we talked about before or not?
Well, nihilism, as I view it, moral nihilism is just a view that there are no moral properties. So earlier I used the term anti-realism. I guess that's the more sort of commonly used term. Nihilism, of course, is a term that has various connotations. But as I use it, it's just claim that there are no moral properties of moral facts. Does it have a connection to moral abolitionism? Well, as I said before, there are very few people who have explicitly defended abolitionists. Those who have defended it, as far as I know, have all been error theorists. But as I see it, there is no logical connection between error theory and moral abolitionism. You could even be a moral realist and an abolitionist. If you think that, for example, our moral thought and discourse promote oppression and inequality and so on, you might think that, well, we have reason, not moral reason, of course, but we have some other kinds of reason to abandon moral thought and discourse. So there's no necessary connection there between nihilism and abolitionism. Mm-hmm. So you could be a normative realist and a moral abolitionist. Well, even a moral realist and a moral abolitionist.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just putting the metaphysical aspect of things aside for a bit, according to moral nihilism and perhaps even error theory, because the claim arguably is the same there, how should we deal with moral judgments epistemically, according to that view?
According to
To
Aristotle?
moral nihilism.
The view implies that, or error theory rather, I mean, nihilism in itself doesn't have any implications for moral, for the epistemology of moral judgments, actually, because it's just a metaphysical thesis or an ontological thesis. But when you combine nihilism with the other claims that sort of constitute error theory, you get skepticism, you get moral skepticism, as I mentioned before, because knowledge implies truth. You cannot know anything that is not true, and since there are no moral truths, we cannot have, so our so we cannot come to know that euthanasia is wrong, for example. Neither can we come to know that euthanasia is right or morally permissible. And one can also hear your question as a, as concerning what should we do with moral judgments if we come to believe in moral nihilism and in moral error theory. And that's just the what's next question again, right? I mean, what to do with moral thought and discourse if we believe in moral error theory. And then again, we have the main alternatives: conservationism, fictionalism, and abolitionism.
So, one last topic then. What is practical philosophy? What are the kinds of questions it deals with? And does it also have some application in ethics?
Yeah, I mean, the expression practical philosophy is really it's well, let me say this, that in Sweden and in Finland, and I'm not sure whether there are any other countries that have this division between practical and theoretical philosophy. It's I'd say a highly artificial convention to
Sorry, does that division come primarily from the Nordic countries, the Scandinavian countries?
yeah. It, well, I wouldn't say it come. I wouldn't say it comes from our countries, but we have it at our universities. So when you take a course in philosophy at a Swedish university, for example, you do it either in practical philosophy or in theoretical philosophy. What's the difference? Well, it's really hard to say, right? I mean, just speaking very generally. Practical philosophy is practical in the sense that it has to do with, in various ways, it has to do with practices, with actions, with the way we organize society, with norms of various sorts, with values, with reasons, virtues, and so on. So, of course, ethics is a very well, one of the main parts of practical philosophy. But of course, in practical philosophy, we're also interested in metaphysical issues and semantic issues and epistemological issues and whatnot. So the boundaries are very fuzzy between theoretical and practical philosophy. In theoretical philosophy, the main topics are the main subjects are philosophy of language and metaphysics and epistemology. And in these in theoretical philosophy, people are usually not primarily interested in normative issues, but sometimes they are actually interested in normative issues as well. So again, the boundaries are very fuzzy. And why we have this distinction at Scandinavian universities or at Swedish universities, at least, I'm not sure. It's just a historical fact. Of course, there is some. I mean, there is a history to the distinction in Immanuel Kant's work, for example, his critique of pure reason and his critique of practical reason. And there is a similar distinction in Aristotle, for example. The distinction or the categorization of philosophy into the practical side and the theoretical side has a long history. But again, the borders are very fuzzy, it's only in Swedish universities and maybe some other countries that we make a big deal out of it.
But are there any, for example, clear-cut examples of, I don't know, questions that would be approached in different ways if we are approaching it from a more theoretical perspective versus a more practical one, or not exactly?
No, that's not the way to view it. It's not a question about different approaches. Some questions that are dealt with in practical philosophy would not be dealt with in theoretical philosophy.
Could you give us some examples?
Take questions in applied ethics, for example. Is euthanasia wrong? Is abortion wrong? These are questions in applied ethics. You don't deal with applied ethics in theoretical philosophy. Similarly, questions about set theory, for example, that's something that belongs in theoretical philosophy. Well, it might come up in practical philosophy, actually, it might come up in practical philosophy as well, but typically it won't. So it's just it's a matter of different questions. It's not a matter of different approaches or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps practical philosophy is more applied to specific, I didn't want to use the word again, but practical contexts, like, for example, so we have certain ethical questions and how should you go about dealing with them in a social context?
Yeah, that's part of practical philosophy. But then, as I've also said, other parts of practical philosophy are highly abstract.
Okay.
At least just as abstract as many issues in theoretical philosophy, like metaethics, for example, that is also sorted under practical philosophy. But as has become clear in our conversation, issues in metaethics are highly abstract, right? Mm-hmm. Similarly, for the debate about free will, it's also often highly abstract, and that's also sorted under practical philosophy. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So, Dr. Olsen, before we go, would you like to tell people where they can find your work on the internet?
They can find some of my work on my departmental webpage, and that's easy to find if you go to the Stockholm Philosophy webpage. And if you want to read some of my work that is not posted there, you can email me, and you can find my email address on the departmental webpage.
Okay, very well. I will be leaving a link to that in the description box of the interview. And Dr. Olsen, thank you again for coming on the show, and it's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Likewise. Pleasure.
Real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Likewise. Pleasure.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, hit the subscription button, all of those things you already know. And please consider supporting the show either on PayPal or Patreon. All of the links will be in the description box of the interview, starting at $1 per month, so it would be a great help. This show is brought to you by Enlights, Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litske and Blanchett, Perga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunder, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert, Gintis, Rutger Vosbo, Weingarter, Beckenberger, Goldstein, then Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Narcio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Mark Blyth, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Thiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Fergal Cusson, Evan Bodrenko, Al Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Liebrandt, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yasila Desaraújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevski, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Saima Fazal, Adrian Yeagi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortés, Ursula Litske, Denise Cook, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy and Trader in NYC, my producers Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Luis Caetano, Tom Vangnagdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardus France, Thomas Trumbull, and Nuno Welder, and my executive producers Michel Rujewski, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.